The World's Number One Enemy by Alan W. Dowd. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, envisions volcanoes of jihad everywhere. He controls 34,000 square miles of territory, an area the size of Costa Rica. He commands an army larger than Belgium's and perhaps larger than Canada's. He has a $2 billion budget at his disposal and reigns over a population of more than 2 million people. Indeed, he is the self-styled leader of a new state, which has a major export, 9,000 barrels of oil per day, and a capital, the Syrian city of Raqqa. He's at war with some of the world's largest, richest, most advanced powers, and he's more than holding his own. In fact, Forbes magazine ranks him the 54th most powerful person in the world. His name is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ultra-violent political, spiritual, military leader of the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, known as ISIS, ISIL, and ICE. His story is at once horrific and tragic. Missed opportunities. Born in Iraq around 1971 and given the name Ibrahim Awad Ibrahim Ali al-Badri, Baghdadi was apprehended by U.S. forces in Fallujah in 2004 during Iraq's post-war insurgency. He was held for some period of time, some reports say 4 years, some say less, in a U.S. prison facility in southern Iraq. While detained, Baghdadi made connections and laid the groundwork for the ruthless killing machine that would become ISIS. The U.S. prison was like a summer camp for ambitious terrorists, a Newsweek account of Baghdadi details. The inmates interacted, traded information and battle tactics, and made important contacts for the future. At some point in the course of transferring sovereignty back to the Iraqi government, Baghdadi appears to have been entrusted to Iraq's civilian authorities, who released him. That's the first tragic element of Baghdadi's story and the first missed opportunity. The second relates to the big picture in Iraq and Syria. Let's start with Iraq. As the surge took hold and turned the tide in Iraq, eviscerating al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, persuading former insurgents to become part of the solution, stabilizing Iraq's politics, and rescuing Iraq from civil war and America from defeat. Most observers thought the United States and Iraq would renew the Status of Forces Agreement, SOFA, to authorize a residual U.S. presence in Iraq. As Vice President Joe Biden said, "I'll bet you my vice presidency, Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, the former Iraqi prime minister, will extend the SOFA." SOFA. Frederick Kagan, one of the architects of the surge, explained that painstaking staff work in Iraq led General Lloyd Austin to recommend trying to keep more than 20,000 troops in Iraq after the end of 2011. But President Obama demanded that the new SOFA be blessed by the Iraqi parliament rather than simply signed by the Iraqi government. He proposed a residual force of just 3,000 troops and made it clear he was willing to withdraw all U.S. forces by the end of 2011, a timetable set by the Bush administration. When Maliki balked, as Kagan reported at the time, the White House went forward with a zero option, despite the fact that no military commander supported the notion that such a course of action could secure U.S. interests. Kagan and others who advocated keeping U.S. forces in Iraq after 2011 feared that the country was not ready to stand on its own. But for Obama, ending U.S. involvement in Iraq was a promise to be kept. After all, the centerpiece of his foreign policy platform as a candidate, indeed the very fuel for his White House run, was always the withdrawal from Iraq. If nothing else, his critics should give him credit for keeping his word. Hence, there was nothing surprising about his impatience with Maliki, decision to follow the Bush administration's timeline, or eagerness to bring America's war in Iraq to a close. Regrettably, nor was there anything surprising about the results. In October 2011, Colonel Salam Khaled of the Iraqi army warned, "Our forces are good, but not to a sufficient degree that allows them to face external and internal challenges alone." In January 2012, General Jeffrey Buchanan worried, "Without all the enablers we provide, there's no doubt there will be less capability than there is right now," adding that if Iraqi troops proved unable to put pressure on jihadist groups, they could regenerate. In 2012, the remnants of AQI morphed into the earliest version of ISIS, the Financial Times reported. By 2014, Baghdadi and ISIS declared independence from al-Qaeda. In summer 2013, Iraq officially began asking for help against Baghdadi and jihadist spillovers from Syria, making urgent requests for U.S. assets to hit terrorist camps. In February 2014, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iraq and Iran, Brett McGurk, told a House committee that ISIS operations are calculated, coordinated, and part of a strategic campaign led by its Syria-based leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, to cause the collapse of the Iraqi state and carve out a zone of governing control in western regions of Iraq and Syria. That same month, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper warned that the protracted civil war in Syria is destabilizing Iraq. That brings us to the other part of the big picture. ISIS has thrived on the symbolic chaos in Iraq and Syria, using the unchecked Syrian civil war as feedstock for its rise. This explains why so many policymakers, including former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, former CIA Director David Petraeus, and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey, advocated sending arms to weaken Syria's Bashar Assad and forestall the radicalization of his opposition. As Clinton recently argued, the failure to help build up a credible fighting force of the people who were the originators of the protests against Assad left a big vacuum, which the jihadists have now filled. Obama's reticence reflected the national mood. Unlike 2003, when the American people and Congress strongly supported regime change in Iraq, there was no consensus to stay in Iraq in 2011 or intervene in Syria in 2013 or return to Iraq in 2014. In other words, if the president deserves criticism for engaging Syria too late and withdrawing from Iraq too early, he deserves credit for reversing course and blunting the ISIS advance. Means and ends. In a region full of bad guys, Baghdadi is arguably the worst. In its initial sweep into Iraq, Baghdadi's army massacred 1,700 unarmed Iraqi soldiers near Tikrit, summarily executed 510 Shiite prisoners in Mosul, shelled apostate homes in Duluya and Zawiya, and ordered Christians to convert, make extortion payments, or die. ISIS has beheaded aid workers, executed American civilians, burned POWs alive, and crucified captured enemy soldiers. ISIS is especially barbaric in its treatment of children and women. ISIS has subjected Yazidi women to systematic rape and sex slavery, according to the Kurdish government. ISIS has imprisoned children as young as 8, executed children as young as 10, flogged children as young as 14, and sold children into slavery. Perhaps most shocking and shameful of all, the United Nations reports that ISIS has used mentally challenged children as suicide bombers. In February, ISIS orchestrated a mass beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians captured in Libya. These Attila the Hun tactics have a power all their own, inflating ISIS into an invincible, inevitable force, and leaving Baghdadi in control of vast swaths of northwestern Iraq and northeastern Syria, along with a network of transportation arteries between Baghdad and the Iraq-Syria border. Baghdadi's means and ends have gotten the world's attention and done the impossible. After all, ISIS has united Shiites and Sunnis, Jews and Muslims, and Christians and Hindus, Persians and Arabs, Kurds and Turks, postmodern Europeans and pre-modern tribesmen, liberal democracies like America and Australia, and revisionist autocracies like Russia and Egypt, reactionary Sunni monarchies like Saudi Arabia, and revolutionary Shiite theocracies like Iran, technologies like the European Union, and gangster regimes like Syria, into the strangest enemy of my enemy coalition in history. Sometimes overtly, sometimes tacitly, sometimes purposely, sometimes coincidentally, the members of this de facto alliance are cooperating to dismantle Baghdadi's machinery of murder. Volcanoes of Jihad. Fighting Baghdadi is not about oil or democracy or even noble notions of standing up for civilization. It's about protecting America and its interests. If you doubt this, consider what national security leaders have said. Baghdadi's jihadist state threatens American personnel and facilities located in the region. If left unchecked, ISIL will pose a threat beyond the Middle East, including to the United States homeland, Obama concludes. The most immediate threat to U.S. national interests is ISIL, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter concludes. Or consider what Baghdadi himself has said. Like America's paranoid World War II foes, he believes his people are under attacks everywhere, listing China, India, Palestine, Somalia, the Arabian Peninsula, the Caucasus, Sham, Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, Egypt, Iraq, Indonesia, Afghanistan, the Philippines, Iran, Pakistan, Tunisia, Libya, Algeria, Morocco, and the West by name. He delights in war. Soldiers of the Islamic State, he howls, erupt, volcanoes of jihad everywhere. Like the leaders of America's Cold War enemies, he hates freedom and wants to upend the liberal global order. Let the world know that we are living today in a new era, an era that will trample the idol of nationalism, destroy the idol of democracy. And like his forefather Osama bin Laden, terror is Baghdadi's weapon of choice. Terrorism is to refuse humiliation, subjugation, and subordination.